All right, this is jaysanalysis.com. This night I have a special treat, an author who has influenced me quite a bit over the years. It's been a long time since I spoke to him. Last time we talked about unified field theory, and that file got lost on a dead computer. That computer is completely, completely frazzled and fizzled. But thankfully, Dr. Farrell has agreed to come back, and tonight we're going to talk about some of his works. What I'd like to start with is something that's a little bit difficult. I found, I think the first time I looked at the topological metaphor chapter in the Giza book, it was very confusing because I was still, you know, pretty relatively new to Neoplatonic theory and looking at, you know, a lot of these Greek terms. It was fuzzy, but I think I have a much better handle on it nowadays. So what I'd like to do is get you to kind of maybe go into some of this, give us an explanation of it, and then how that kind of undergirds where you take a lot of your other research and work.
Well, it's an unusual idea. Harvard, they're the Harvard Norton Poetry Lectures for 1973. They're titled The Unanswered Question, but what he does in those lectures is he takes music and explains it using Chomskyan models of grammar to non-musical audiences. So basically what he's doing is he's doing music theory, or a kind of meta music theory in a way, and showing kind of common structures that occur both in language and in music. And that really kind of inspired me, because what he was doing there is he was taking analogical thinking to a very high pitch. And I started playing around with it. I actually bought Chomsky's books as a result of watching those lectures and read them, and his linguistics books. And I started playing around with basically a kind of topology of analogies, if you want to look at it that way. And I came to, eventually, this is a work that I've been doing for quite some time when I have the time to do it. I came to the conclusion that if you took the various metaphysical systems that existed in classic times, Neoplatonism you mentioned being one of them, you could do the same with Vedic systems, you could do the same even with Christian systems, with Buddhist systems, and took away all of the language and used a symbolic notation for what they were talking about. Something very interesting occurs, and I call it the topological metaphor of the medium, because this gets to be a particularly intriguing way to look at Platonism, Neoplatonism, some of the Hermetic texts. So let's do a thought experiment to explain what it is, or try to. Put it that way. It's always better to say to try, because sometimes I'm not too good at putting this into speech. But imagine a sea of infinitely extended sameness. In other words, you cannot imagine any distinctions within it. This would be what the Neoplatonists would call simplicity, or ablotis. But you could also say it's a nothing in a physics term, because in the physics sense, because in physics, in order to be a something, it has to be observable. It has to have distinction.
Right.
Now imagine you take this nothing or no thing and cleave it. At the very instant that you do, in other words, you're imagining a mathematical function which itself allows you to do this, and that function is itself negatively specified, all right? So in other words, you're making a kind of a formal definition. Imagine there exists a function that allows you to do this, so you cleave it. Now, what do you have when you cleave that nothing? You have three things, actually. You've got what topologists would call a region, one region, you have another region, and then you have the common surface between the two, which is itself a nothing, and it's also infinite. So you've got three infinities, but the difference now is what you've started to do, in at least the mathematical terms, is you started to add information to the system, all right? And in the formal description, this is a very important point for people to understand, in the formal description of each of these three things, or three nothings, differentiated nothings, as it were, what you've done is you've added information, but the formal description still contains the symbolization of the original nothing that you've cleaved. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what you've also done is you've set up, if I can put it this way, you've set up a mathematical formalization of an analogical process, because analogies, if you look at them carefully, analogies, when you move from one context to another and say, oh, this is analogous to that, mm-hmm. This in language is to that in music, what you've done is you've noticed that there's some common element, and I'm using that term very deliberately, there's some common element between these two contexts that carries over. So in other words, you're setting up the conditions of analogical thinking, which mm-hmm. to me is a fascinating result, because you, when you get to the Neoplatonists, when you get to some of the Egyptian thinking, when you get to the Hermeticists, this is what you see them doing. And one of the things I thought was very interesting about this is it gives kind of a convenient way to show why in so many of those ancient cultures you had the practice of sympathetic magic. Right. You had it because in their cosmology you had this idea that everything came from some primordial nothingness, ex nihilo. Mm-hmm. So it became a way for them to relate everything to everything else, to have a transcendental unity to things.
Right.
But it's also a very analogical process. So that in brief.
Well, no, that's great. That's great. Let me ask you this, if you don't mind. So this is the same pattern that I see with what we see with, say, the Egyptian deities, as you mentioned, where the deities kind of come to stand for these principles,
right,
or these mathematical forms or whatever. And so if you thought about it in terms of geometry, this is essentially the same point that's being made in Pythagoreanism, where you have a dot,
right,
and then the extension from the dot is the line, and then that creates, you know, like you said, three things, because you have the point, the line, and then wherever the point terminates.
Right.
So we're that's where we get a plane from, and so the plane would then be, you know, 1D dimension reality. So
right.
Would it be correct to say that it's the Greek idea of what they call the gnomon, that the sort of a fractal mirroring of things is what's going on here?
Yeah, I like that idea of fractal. You mentioned the Pythagoreans, and I assume that what you're referring to there is the tetrahedrons, you know, the
right.
one dot, and then you've got
right.
two, then you've got three, then you've got four. And to them, this was one of the great secrets, you know, of their mystery school. And you have to wonder why, you know.
Exactly.
It's just a bunch of dots in a triangle.
Right.
And but when you look at it, as you say, when you look at it with kind of geometrical or topological lenses on, what they're really describing is something very profound. You start out with a point or a dot, or in mathematical terms, a scalar, a one-dimensional entity. Then you go to two, that's a two-dimensional entity. You go to mm-hmm. three, that's three dimensions. And you go to four, which is interesting because that implies four spatial dimensions.
Right.
Now, that may seem to some of our listeners, that may seem to be just the wildest sort of, bizarre and out-of-the-box speculation. But there's something very interesting to note about the Babylonians. And I ran into this researching, Grid of the Gods. The notation system that Babylonians used to describe higher numbers was, if we were to graph it today, it was a kind of a parenthesis notation with one number and then a comma and then another number and then a closed parenthesis. Well, interestingly enough, if you look at modern mathematical systems for notating hyperdimensional objects, In other words, take a tetrahedron and put it into four spatial dimensions. How do you describe that mathematically? Well, they use a technique called Schlaefli numbers, and a Schlaefli number does precisely that. It gives you a bracketed set of numbers. So in other words, even we have a clue that maybe they were thinking in some of these terms even there, which I find very, very interesting. It's intriguing and suggestive, let's put it that
so,
way.
So you're saying that Schlaefli numbers, in terms of set theory, even goes back to possibly Babylonian conceptions of how we can have these fourth, fifth possible, dimensions going up.
Right.
Wow.
Now, that, yeah, it's an interesting hypothesis. And what really got me going was, and I got to tell this story because I found notions like this in three people that just blew my mind when I came across it. There are three mathematicians in the early Enlightenment, and I won't mention their names right off the top here because I want it to be kind of a surprise to people. The first guy that I read says, "Okay, yeah, I've been reading the ancient mathematicians and geometers, and it occurs to me in reading them that it looks like they may have had a form of analysis which has either been lost or suppressed." Right. And it's very clear from the context that he thinks it was suppressed. Okay.
Wow.
And his name is René Descartes.
Wow, yeah, now.
I thought, okay, this guy that made all of my high school linear algebra courses the nightmare
right.
that they were is noticing these things. I thought, well, that's interesting. It'd be interesting to know who he's reading that he comes to that conclusion. Right. I suspect Pappus or maybe even Proclus,
one of these Greek or Renaissance
Neoplatonist authors that are very into mathematics. All right, so then I run into another guy, and he says, "Yeah, I've been reading the same geometers, and I've noticed kind of the same thing that Descartes has noticed, and they disguise their analysis in words." But it appears to me that they had some technique of doing things that has been lost to us, and his name is Isaac Newton.
Well, let me ask you this, because this touches on something that I've looked into a little bit the last couple of years. I think it was Daniel Jones sent me an article 2 years ago, and it was a blog that a guy had done about. I'm going to draw a blank here. Gödel had found manuscripts that he believed were Leibniz's Characteristica Universalis.
Right.
And that these manuscripts have been suppressed. And so is there a possible connection with the same idea here of a universal language of logic? Yeah.
Okay, let me get to Gödel, because I was going to get there in connection with what you mentioned. Okay. The third guy that I ran across was precisely Leibniz. All right, and of the three, Leibniz is this crazy mad genius,
Right.
That and he says the same thing as Newton and Descartes, but he goes even further. He says, "I've not only noticed that they may have had a form of analysis, but that," he goes on to say, "and it had nothing to do with numbers, but they were able to produce results by what he calls an imitation of calculation." Those are his exact words. And on top of this, he not only gives you the impression that he thinks this was, again, something deliberately suppressed, but he goes on to say, "and I think I have found some lineaments of this system." Okay? And that's an extremely interesting thing to say, because I think what these three men may have done is stumbled across or been thinking in terms of something similar to what I've been calling the topological metaphor of the medium. Well, in Gödel's case, the very interesting thing is that he comes across manuscripts that he thinks indicate that Leibniz had actually developed this Characteristica Universalis, this
right.
kind of universal calculus that he was trying to create, and that this had somehow also been suppressed. Now, I have never found, and I know the article that you're referring to that Mr. Jones sent you, because if I'm not mistaken, I may have been the one that sent it to him.
Okay.
But Gödel is an extremely interesting guy, because, you know, here's a guy that does kind of the same thing.
Right.
In his proof, he comes up with a mathematical proof, a Boolean type of proof that basically says you can't have any complete formal system. It always has to have reference to something informal. In other words, it has to have reference, if I can put it this way, to normal language.
Right.
All right. So in other words, no mathematical system, which if you look at mathematical systems a certain way, Chomskyan way, they're nothing but grammars, mm-hmm. really. They're shorthands, Gregg shorthands for big, long sentences. So I think clearly these three guys were aware that there was something going on in these ancient texts and that it had some sort of mathematical qualities to it. So, yeah, I think maybe they were talking in terms, or maybe thinking in terms, kind of like what I've been talking about with this topological metaphor. And one final comment here. Leibniz actually, in some of his papers, referred to what he called analysis situ. In other words, a mathematical technique of analyzing things in situation, all right? So in other words, Leibniz is coming very, very close to the modern idea of higher order topologies.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually making some significant stabs, you know, he centuries ahead of the actual development of combinatorics and topology.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know.
That's crazy. I came across a comment in Leibniz that it sounds like a robot, and so, you know, he comes close to, you know, well, he's obviously a formative person in the development of, you know, computers, but mm-hmm. one thing I'd like to ask you here is that, real quick, there was a little bit of a cutout on my recording at the beginning. You did say Howard Bernstein, right?
In terms Leonard of, Bernstein.
Leonard Bernstein, excuse me.
Right.
So I was mm-hmm. cut out a little bit there. Okay, so I've looked at crystallography some in the last year or two, mm-hmm. and I see some interesting parallels with, say, some of the pop-ish writers on dimensions, like Lisa Randall. When she talks about these higher dimensions, she says we can find actual patterns of this in nature, where nature reflects the correct symmetry or geometry of what this dimension might look like, you know, a tesseract mm-hmm. and things like that. And she mm-hmm. points to certain things like quasi-crystals and all that. So not to get too far out there, but do you think there's a interesting place for crystallography in all this study, especially when we look at the fact that, you know, crystals are so central to things like Hadron colliders and different mm-hmm. types of engines and things like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, I pointed out in the book, Giza, Death Star Deployed, where I first put out a portion of a paper that I had written privately for myself about this metaphor idea. I actually shared it with a mathematics friend of mine. He told me, you know, he read this thing and he said, oh, this makes my head hurt. And he handed it back to me. He says, well, you're either a crackpot or this is very profound. But he said, there's no middle ground.
No middle ground.
Take that for whatever it's worth. But I've shared some of this with other people with kind of a mathematical background. I did a paper, private paper, just in the last week, and shared it with a physicist type person into information processing mm-hmm. with a good physics background. And she came back and said, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. But let's get to crystals. If you look at this topological metaphor and you keep repeating this process of, mm-hmm. of differentiating or cleaving, as I called it at the beginning, what you start to get is you get a lattice structure.
Mm-hmm.
You get a kind of virtual crystal that's being mathematically described. And in the Giza Death Star Deployed, destroyed, I pointed out that the pyramid itself, the Great Pyramid, is a huge crystal. It's made out of crystal-bearing rock, and it's structured so that the angles of the faces are exactly the angles of a quartz crystal, you know, the tip of a quartz crystal. So in other words, it's a huge crystal analog, let's put it that way. And then it's got, on the inside, it's got empty structures. It's got empty places, which would function in the crystal analogy as lattice defects. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing about crystals is they have particular types of defects, screw defects, Schottky displacements, and so on and so forth, which you can describe mathematically. There are actually formulae for the energy it takes to displace a lattice, okay, a node in the lattice.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about crystals is you can describe them. You can describe this lattice structure with tensor calculus, which is, of course, a higher dimensional mathematical tool of analysis that is used quite a bit, actually, in relativity. You
mentioned it quite theory. A bit in unified field, so I recall, yeah.
Right, yeah. It's a, you know, it's used in general relativity. It was used by Gabriel Krohn quite a bit in his electrical engineering, which was a revolutionary step. So, yeah, you can describe these things, these types of higher dimensional things, as she said, in a higher dimensional mathematical topology. And that, again, is an intriguing observation because mm-hmm. you go back to some of the thinking in Kabbalah, Jewish esotericism, and they have this idea that space is a crystal. And, you know, again, why would they come up with such a profound notion way back when? You know, where is this coming from? And that's really what kind of intrigues me here, is you've got all of these indications, even from some profound mathematical thinkers, that there's something going on in all of these ancient texts and mystery schools that is of a highly mathematical nature, and we've simply got to rediscover whatever this is.
Yeah, Vitruvian Man, James Kelly. Yes. James Kelly did a good piece on how there seems to be forerunners of that in Vedic thought, with the altar, the construction of the altar, and Pythagorean theorem being sort of laid out in that altar.
Right.
It also makes me think of Plato's Phaedrus or Phaedo, where at the end there's a discussion of higher dimensions, and he says specifically that there's a crystalline structure to this other world.
Yes.
And he says that the color spectrum that we see is just a fraction of what the colors are actually out there.
Yeah.
So I've always, I've always found it amazing that, you know, probably the best argument I would say is when you look at these ancient texts and you see things like that, you see Plato and the Timaeus, you know, describing sort of the subatomic and geometric structure of how things are at a very small level. There's no way he could have known that apart from something else going on.
Yeah, I think Plato, of all of these ancient writers, is probably the most intriguing. Because there's an American professor, Ernst McLean, is his name. He's written two wonderful books about music theory as it's embodied in Plato's texts. One is a book called The Pythagorean Plato, and the other is called The Myth of Invariance. These are two wonderful books about the ancient cosmology, the role of music theory in it. And it's very clear from his analysis that Plato is, as you say, he's coming up with this from somewhere. And Plato even provides a hint in the fact that he is indicating that he's learned many of these things. He's referring to initiation and so on and so forth. So he's getting it from somewhere. Now, one of the most interesting things about Plato is if you look at the old Jesuit Roman Catholic philosopher Copleston and his wonderful series of philosophy, texts.
History, yeah.
Yeah, Copleston comes up with a very interesting table of how the Platonic system works. And he has ta mathematica, the mathematicals is what Plato calls them, where these are the higher forms. And it's interesting that Plato uses this word, because had he known the term, or had he had access to higher order topologies, he would have probably called them the topologies, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But his hint here is something very profound, because what he's suggesting is that the standard academic presentation of the world of the universals, of the forms, is not simply, you know, a chair, a universal chair that has the form of all chairs. What he's actually suggesting is that this is a mathematical entity,
yes,
rather than, you know, a chairness, or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, I think these guys are clearly giving clues that they're receiving a heritage and they're trying to explain it as best as they can. Another one along those lines would be Iamblichus, the Neoplatonic philosopher, mm-hmm, you know, the theology of arithmetic. And it's, again, it's very clear that he's dealing in a very metaphorical way with highly abstract mathematical ideas.
Oops. Let me ask you this, because the first thing I think of is that, again, for persons who might be skeptical or think that this doesn't have any real relevance or connection to things today, that we've all, you know, we've parsed all this out into a kind of reductionism where math is just token symbols and all this stuff. This is from Werner Heisenberg. He says, all the particles, he's talking about things at the subatomic level. He says, all particles are made of the same substance, energy, but the resemblance of the modern views to those of Plato and the Pythagoreans can be carried somewhat further. The elementary particle in Plato's Timaeus are finally not substance, but mathematical forms. He says, the equation of motion holds at all times. It is in this sense eternal, whereas the geometrical forms, like the orbits, are changing. Therefore, the mathematical forms that represent the elementary particles will be solutions of some eternal law of motion for matter. This is a problem which has not yet been resolved. So here we have Werner Heisenberg, you know, one of the premier quantum physicists, saying that, you know, at that level of reality, the subatomic level, we're actually dealing with what he specifically says, Platonic Pythagorean notions here.
Yes. Yeah, and I'm glad you read that quotation, though. Isn't that from Physics and Philosophy? One of his two books he wrote. Heisenberg is interesting here because what he's suggesting is something I've been trying to communicate to people. You know, people think of particles and quantum mechanics as being these little tiny billiard balls, you know, that they're whirling around in their Large Hadron Colliders. And what they really are their packets of mathematical information.
Right.
That's exactly what Heisenberg is saying. And again, he's exactly right, because you look at the mathematical descriptions of these things, and what they're really doing is they're describing topologies, geometries, that are the only way that you can describe these things and make any sense out of them. And, you know, that raises all sorts of conundrums about, mm-hmm, well, exactly what are they spinning around in their machines?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I take the view, yeah, they're spinning around little packets of mathematical information.
Well, you know, Brian Greene even says that in his in his pop books. He even says that at that level, it seems to be information. We have studies coming out that light encodes information. So let me ask you this. What is your view of light in relationship to these things?
Well, you know, you have the wave particle duality in modern mathematical descriptions of light. And, you know, this led to all sorts of philosophical, and they're still going on, these philosophical debates in modern physics. But the bottom line is, and let's go back with this to something that you pointed out with an earlier quotation from the Pythagoreans, I believe it was, that you're looking at one very small end of the spectrum, okay? Light is energy. Mm-hmm. So as such, it's got a specific information content in the form of frequency. Mm-hmm. And you look at the whole spectrum, not just the auditory spectrum, but not just the optical spectrum, but the entire spectrum of the harmonic series, and something very interesting pops out. And I've mentioned this many, many times in my books, and I'm not sure that I've ever put it clearly enough for people to really latch on to. The first unification in physics is not electromagnetism, it's music.
Right.
And the reason why is, and again, this is what Bernstein brings out in his lectures so very well in the very first lecture. If you take any fundamental, say the note C on a piano keyboard, in the naturally occurring harmonic series, there's going to be an overtone that lies in the crack between B flat and A in the naturally occurring series. And what this meant was, if you were to tune a keyboard instrument to the natural series, you could not modulate or change key from one key to another during the course of a piece. You'd have to stop and retune the entire instrument in order to do that. So what happened was, and the Pythagoreans pick up on this, they call this the Pythagorean comma. What happened was, is you have from a very early period in Vedic literature and Pythagorean literature, you have this idea that if we just could figure out what this interval was, we could tweak it. We could engineer, and this is a key word here, we could engineer a slight adjustment to make the harmonic series perform with all 12 notes. Interesting, it's a Sumerian number, 12 notes, on the keyboard, and bring about a unification of the harmonic series. Now, let's take that idea, which they did, of course. You know, this is what happens finally in Western music after the Renaissance. You have that mathematical adjustment being done, which gives rise to our Western music that we still listen to today, from Bach to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, what happens then? What could we find an interval to do that with the entire harmonic series? And of course, once you've put it that way, you've basically raised the question of a physical unification of sciences based around light. Now, interestingly enough, the physicist David Bohm actually made some stabs in that direction. He tried to compute what that, or calculate what that number may have been, and I don't recall right off the top of my head what it was, but he made some stabs in that direction. So yeah, I think light here, again, is, you know, so many mystical treatises from mm-hmm. all the way from India to medieval Europe are talking about light as somehow fundamental to all of this. Right. And again, we have indicators that it very well may be.
Yeah, it makes me think of Renaissance thinkers as well as ancient Greek thinkers having the idea of the celestial sphere and the celestial intelligences mm-hmm. sort of resonating at different pitches or notes.
Yes. Yeah, this is, you know, it's all the way from Dionysius Areopagite to Seeger of Brabant. You have this idea of light. And again, the question is why? Where is this coming from? And I suspect, you know, along with Newton and Leibniz and Descartes, I suspect that somehow this is all part of a very high science that may have existed in high antiquity that was subsequently lost or perhaps deliberately obscured. Mm-hmm. And they've been trying to get back to it. And Heisenberg, again, you know, you mentioned that wonderful quotation from Heisenberg. Heisenberg is one of these very erudite, learned men of letters, which scientists back then tended to be. And Heisenberg is expressing something, I think, very profound, that scientists back then, Heisenberg, Paul Dirac, Walter Gerlach, these guys were very aware that they were getting close to something that looked very similar to some very ancient ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that's another indicator that there's something going on way back when.
What do you think about Dirac's idea that energy is kind of borrowed from the future, and rather than everything being this sort of negative vacuum, that it's actually, we're actually in the midst of a constant sea of energy? I mean, that seems to fit well with the idea that everything is basically energy at a certain level.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think Dirac is correct. And Dirac and John Stuart Bell and people like this, Dirac is an interesting guy because, as you say, he's got this idea that you're borrowing energy from the future. Well, if that's the case, what people really have to latch onto here is what Dirac is really suggesting, is that time in the mathematical descriptions of relativity, the way that time as a simply a delta t function or a fourth coordinate in a coordinate system, that's an inadequate mathematical description. Mm-hmm. What he's suggesting, if I can use the mathematical term, he's suggesting that time is not a scalar. In other words, it's not that first point in the Pythagorean tetradus. It's further down. It's mm-hmm. got its own kind of multidimensional characteristics. Well, that's interesting because in the Soviet Union, back in the late 50s, early 60s, a very famous Soviet astrophysicist by the name of Nikolay Kozarev. Nikolay Kozarev was noticing that the sun, according to the chained up hydrogen bomb model, wasn't spitting out enough neutrinos. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he decided, well, there has to be some other energy source going on here. And he speculated that it was time, you know, following Dirac's suggestion. Mm-hmm. And what happened then, Jay, was very interesting. What happened then was Kozarev was roundly denounced in Pravda as a quack, a fraud.
Yeah. You know?
And this guy is an internationally renowned astrophysicist. So in other words, it's like suddenly calling Einstein a fraud and a charlatan. Okay.
Well, and the Soviet party had that guidelines, yeah, where the party determined what science was. You could,
yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, Cardinal Bellarmine lived inside the Soviet Union for a while. And so they denounced Kozarev in Pravda. What really happened was they took him out of the public view and shoved him into some very classified research projects. Was what really happened. And we didn't learn this until after the fall of the Soviet Union, that Kozarev had been doing all of this highly classified torsion research inside the Soviet Union and designing these very weird devices based on his research that time was not a scalar. And you know, this didn't occur, and we didn't find out about any of this until after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that Kozarev had in fact been publicly denounced so that they could, you know, take the idea out of the public eye and research all of this in black projects. So yeah, I think, you know, that's an indicator right there that Dirac was on to something, and that immediately it was appreciated by scientists, and probably, you know, just the Soviets were probably not the only ones that decided, let's investigate this in our secret research. I don't see how anything else could have happened at that point.
Now, without going too far into something that you may not care to talk about, if we look at Tesla, mm-hmm. and I know that HARP and all that gets kind of overplayed, but weather modification in general seems to have this same principle at work at base with the manipulation of frequencies. I mean, when we go mm-hmm. to Stanford, .vlf.edu, they've got hundreds of papers on extremely low frequencies, very low frequencies, and how this affects, you know, the geoengineering plans and strategies that are going on. So this is the same principle here, right? So in other words, just because we're dealing with weather, we're still dealing with frequencies and the spectrum here of
yes.
electromagnetic stuff. So could you go into some of that and how you think that possibly relates? Because it's almost like there's not just the advanced tech that is for good things. It can also be used for weaponization, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a really, you're kind of opening a Pandora's box there. I talked about that very thing last year at the Secret Space Program conference in San Mateo, California. Let me kind of set it up here for you and what I think may be going on, because if I just come out and tell you what they're doing, I don't think the impact will be quite the same. At the end of World War II, the national security establishment of the West, of the United States, has a threefold strategic problem, in my opinion. First, they've got to deal with the communist bloc. They are also dealing with inescapable evidence that somewhere in the world, the Nazis are still developing all of their bizarre technology. And thirdly, they've got a UFO problem. So they've got to scramble to figure out, develop crash technologies that can do the reconnaissance to find out, you know, what are the Soviets up to? Where are these Nazis and what are they doing? Mm-hmm. There are indications in the literature that they already know they're in South America, but, you know, satellites don't exist at that time. So they develop these crash programs to develop reconnaissance satellites, spy satellites. But the other thing they're going to do is they're going to put into place a long-term mega Manhattan project, as it were, to investigate the UFO phenomenon, number one, to develop the hypotheses of what they might be dealing with, number two. And I think they're going to look at quite a few, quite frankly. But number three, they're going to develop a crash program on the hypothesis that some UFOs represent a technology, whether human or otherwise. They're going to develop a program to develop the technologies to emulate the performance characteristics of UFOs. And that's going to take a lot of money over a long time. Now let's assume we add a fourth assumption here to their thinking. We're trying to reverse engineer the policy formation culture that these people are confronted with. And the fourth thing they're going to think is, okay, we have clear indications from some of these UFO incidents of at least provocative, if not hostile, behavior. So we also had better develop technologies that can defend ourselves. And this is where it gets interesting, because if you're dealing with a capability to get from there to here, wherever there may be, and by that time it's also becoming clear that the other planets in the solar system aren't very good candidates for intelligent life as we know it. So they begin to develop the assumption, well, they're coming from outside this system, most likely. And even if they're coming from within this system, we had better be able to demonstrate a technological capability to defend ourselves. So what do? You develop the capability to engineer systems of a planetary scale at the minimum, and incidentally, systems of a stellar scale. In other words, to manipulate the sun itself. And how are you going to do that? Well, weather manipulation is one, because weather is a planetary scale system. The Earth itself is another system that they're going to start thinking in terms of weaponizing the geophysics of the Earth. And, and again, Tesla, you know, with his earthquake machine.
Right.
But HARP is an interesting thing here. Because these ionospheric heaters, let's stop and explain what the physics is here so that people can kind of get a basic grasp of what's going on. These ionospheric heaters are using the resonance cavity, the conductivity of the atmosphere itself, the ionosphere in particular, way out there, to manipulate planetary effects. Now, here's the problem. To do that, you have to know the resonance features of the ionosphere. In other words, what frequencies are going to function the best in that electrical cavity? Now, once you've said resonance, you're going to deal with the phenomenon that radio engineers all over the world had to deal with back when radio was the way we communicated. And that is, you can tune receivers in such a way, if you have capacitors attached to them, to bleed off all of the power from a transmitter. So in other words, you are effectively closing a circuit, just like Tesla's wireless transmission of energy. Okay, you're closing a circuit. Well, if you imagine the sun now as a transmitter, it is, it's a huge radio transmitter. You can take that same technology and couple a circuit, quite literally, through resonance effects to the sun. And this is a scary thing, because this means that possibly, and I am underscoring the word here, possibly, that you could create a technology that would have a resonance effect once you close the circuit with the sun. So in other words, they're playing around, in my opinion, they began playing around with these gigantic systems engineering simply for the purpose of demonstrating a capability far exceeding hydrogen bombs for humanity to defend itself, if necessary, against whatever it is that they were encountering in their black projects now, and UFO reports.
Would this tie into the idea of the electric universe, that basically what we're dealing with is a sun that's basically an engine? Yes. And if we can just tap into that energy, we would have, because presumably this would require massive amounts of energy.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, resonance is an unusual thing because you can accomplish a lot with it if you know how. The old adage of soldiers marching across a bridge, they break step. And the reason they break step is if they keep pulsing the bridge long enough, they're going to load so much energy into the bridge that the bridge cannot damp it and it will collapse. All right. So they damp the energy by breaking steps so that they're not pulsing it in resonance all the time. Okay. The same principle is involved here. Tesla said very specifically, give me the right resonance, in other words, of the planet itself, and I can crack the planet. I can break it in half. So in other words, yeah, this is what they're dealing with. And with the sun, you try to kind of establish that kind of resonance principle in order to tap those energies. So yeah, absolutely.
And so that's just the basic idea of the opera singer singing and breaking the glass, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So
exactly.
Let me ask you this. How does, when we read about HAARP and we go to the different, like there's a Navy.mil paper that came out a year or two ago that talks about HAARP and plasma. And when I look back at, you know, Greek thought, you know, plasma played an important part in the Greek idea of the elements, the fifth element and so forth. So how does plasma fit into this with regard to the possibilities of what they might be doing?
Well, as far as ancient thinking goes, I think, yeah, plasma is a good candidate for that fifth element, for that alchemical quintessence, because plasma is, you know, it's the breakdown of the electric bonding of electrons, all right? So in other words, you're creating an electron ion soup, quite literally. And what this will do in modern terms, what I think they might be doing, is they're trying to create the electrical conditions in the ionosphere that through plasma manipulation, in other words, you're creating a plasma in the ionosphere, it's what you're doing. That would allow you to do any number of things depending on how you configure the plasma. It would allow you to interrupt communications. In other words, you could switch everything off. You and I wouldn't be having this conversation. You could, through certain resonance effects by beam mixing in a certain area, you could create a huge electrical dipole between the ionosphere and the Earth, which would result in enormous electrical lightning strikes, enormous. And this would be something that you could target, you could repeat in a certain area, all right? So you'd have these enormous lightning bursts falling on the same place over and over as the charge differential built back up every time. So you could do that with it. You could engineer weather systems by creating thermal differentials in the ionosphere that are going to steer weather systems a particular way. You can do all sorts of stuff with this. And if you go back and look at those early Bernard Eastland patents that actually set up HAARP to begin with, if you look at them carefully, he's proposing all of this, missile defense, weather modification.
Right.
It's very clear.
Yeah, now, speaking of the lightning, I recall seeing a couple years ago the declassified DARPA budget, and one of the things that they were involved in was tapping into the extreme amount of energy of lightning, because there's thousands of bulbs, millions, however many it was, you know, going on at once all over the globe.
Right.
So the idea, you know, being, could we tap into all these lightning bolts? And I suspect that if that was the release budget, there's probably a lot more going on than just tapping into lightning bolts.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, to do that, you have to have a system that is able to engineer the planet on that scale.
Right.
So, in other words, yeah, you've got the earth itself then, in a certain sense, becomes your capacitor. It becomes your dielectric. And you're drawing on all of that energy that's been built up in planet Earth. And the way you do that, in my opinion, would be you would you'd start pulsing the earth, but you'd do it at different places on the surface of the planet. You'd create standing waves, basically, strong enough that you would move them through the planet, and as these different waves are intersecting at certain points on the planet, there you're going to get a tremendous scalar potential where all the vectors are adding up to a pure magnitude of force at that particular place. And again, I suspect that this is part of the physics thinking that may have been behind what some people call the world grid, and why we find all of these ancient structures at peculiar locations on, you know, very clearly thought out locations on the planet's surface. Giza, Teotihuacan, Angkor Wat, Pumupunku, Teotihuacan, I think I already mentioned. So, yeah, these things are positioned at places where it would be natural to have these interfered standing waves in the planet meeting. And, you know, that again, you know, I know I sound like a nut, but that again implies what well, they're doing is they're playing around with physics.
That's what, right. It's
a very sophisticated sort.
If we keep in mind what we said earlier, that the principles that we're talking about that you've mentioned with topology and with reality being so highly structured, you know, at just the fabric of reality itself being information, then it would stand to reason that that was always the case. And if that was always the case, then this structure would be applicable 1,000 years ago. I mean, it was still the case then too. We're just discovering something that was either known before or is becoming known. So
yeah, exactly.
Let me ask you about how this ties into transhumanism, if you don't mind going there.
Sure.
Because what we're doing here is I watched a lecture by Regina Dugan, who was at Bilderberg this year, the former DARPA head who went to Google. And in that lecture about 3 years ago, she was talking about how really all DARPA does is discover the secrets of nature and then improve on them. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing here with turning Earth itself into a kind of technology, which is what you're describing, mm-hmm. leads further. There's all sorts of possibilities that might come out of this. And so once again, with alchemy, the homunculus, the golem, all of these ideas of transhumanism have older precedents as well. So tell us about what you think about the Philosopher's Stone and transhumanism and where it's going.
Well, I wrote a book with a friend of mine, Dr. Scott DeHart. We called it Transhumanism, and then the subtitle to it is A Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas, because when we looked at the transhumanism movement, beyond the fact that much of it seems to have no concept of the transcendental or any sort of traditional moral restraint on the application of technology, beyond this, we noticed something very curious. The transhumanists are talking about four technologies, the GRIN technologies: genetics, robotics, information technology, and nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing, if you take the whole spectrum of engineering, human engineering, from genetic modification of food, you know, the whole GMO issue,
right,
to the idea that they can down or upload a person's memory through nanotechnology, the biological repair of the body on a cell-by-cell basis, you know, to achieve some sort of virtual immortality, which I think would be a huge mistake. But, you know, we have the warning of St. John Chrysostom that there's a reason we die, and that is so we don't progress in evil, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you've got all of these ideas, and Scott and I were literally, when I lived out there in California and we were writing this book, we had one session in my apartment where we were both just kind of pacing back and forth, trying to figure out what really is the key here? What's going on? And I forget if it was him or me, we finally decided what we're looking at is alchemy.
Right.
And the reason we're looking at alchemy is if you look at the whole body of transhumanist literature, what are they talking about? Well, they're talking about, in some very radical cases, the engineering of the androgyne. In other words, making bisexual human beings or asexual or whatever. In other words,
right.
They're looking at the very top scale of that ancient preoccupation with the androgyne as the symbol of that initial nothing that subsequently gets cleaved.
Right, correct.
All right?
Right.
And then below that, if you look at Hermetic texts, the standard Western esoteric tradition, if you will, then you have the idea of four atoms or four men or four humanities: the androgynous man, the mineral man, which oddly enough is the next highest level of mankind. Then you get vegetable man. And then finally you get animal man, which is what we are now, which is the lowest level. So looking at those four technologies and the whole spectrum of engineering of the totality of not only the human environment, but the human being himself,
mm-hmm.
What it looked to us that they were really trying to do covertly, very, very covertly, was reascend that alchemical ladder. So in other words, we suspect that ultimately the transhumanist agenda is really a very esoteric agenda. It's really a very occult agenda.
Right.
And in my opinion, and I'm not speaking for Dr. DeHart here, but in my opinion, a very black one.
Do you think? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, is it the same idea of basically when you describe the topological metaphor, you kind of have this collapsing of the previously ascribed deity or personal characteristics to things like we might ascribe to God or to different Egyptian deities or whatever. These are actually principles operant in the world. So is there a collapsing from that transcendent realm into this realm, this plane? And is it the same idea with classic notions of immortality or even the Christian idea of resurrection has basically just been collapsed into this realm? And that so kind of in a deus ex machina, it has to arise out of our realm.
Oh, yeah, I certainly think you can look at it that way. And in fact, I think there are transhumanists that would look at it that way. The disturbing thing to me about the transhumanist movement is that they are defining personhood by the natural attributes of humanity. In other words, they're committing the old error that John of Damascus, a very famous Christian father, warned about back in the 7th century when he said that the error of all the heresies is that they say that person and nature are the same.
Yeah.
So I think that's the huge danger, because you see what they're doing is they're defining personhood by memory. They're defining personhood by emotion and so on. And personhood, if you stop and think about it, isn't any of these things. It's always more than the sum total of those things. So in other words, personhood itself, in a certain sense, becomes that primordial nothingness, because there's no analogy to what constitutes the individual person, all right? So other than the fact of its absolute uniqueness. And in that case, yeah, you have analogies. You're analogous to me in that you're a person. But, mm-hmm. You are Jay Dyer and I'm Joseph Farrell, and that's as far as the analogy goes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you're right. I think they are collapsing, dangerously so. They're collapsing the notion of person into, and again, this is the typical, as far as I'm concerned, it's the typical error of Western culture,
right,
which we see over and over in law and jurisprudence and even in the way that corporations are supposedly persons, they're collapsing the notion of person into the natural faculties.
And, exactly.
And again, you know, and then they want to make that immortal.
Yeah, and some of them will. Some of them even talk about the fact that, like Martine Rothblatt and her mm-hmm. copycat lover person that this the robot they ascribe the fact that the memories that have been stored mm-hmm. they view it like that's actually the person, just because it's, in other words, a recording is not the same thing as the thing itself, right?
Exactly.
So
exactly.
It makes me think of, and you highlighted this so long ago in God, History, Dialectic, that what happened in the West was that when we got to the point where the notion of simplicity was such that it basically erased personhood as a unique characteristic. So
yeah.
What Aristotle, and I just did a piece on this about hylomorphism, when that becomes somewhat problematic for people like Aquinas, they have to tweak it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But for the average philosophers out there, by the time of the Enlightenment, as you well know, these accidental categories of Aristotle are basically no different than the substance, because the right. empirical perception that you have of the secondary qualities for the British empiricists is no different than the empirical perception that you have of the so-called primary quality, right? So right. basically they're all secondary qualities. And so how would we define a thing? Well, it's just the sum of its secondary qualities.
Right.
So there's nothing transcendent, and that's exactly what you just said, right? That this is how the West has completely divorced itself from anything transcendent.
Yeah, and it's, you know, let's point out something else that falls out of the topological metaphor, and this you see, I think, very clearly in those Neoplatonic philosophies. You see it very clearly in various Eastern religions and philosophies. And that is, if you take that initial undifferentiated nothing and say, well, that's person, okay? And then you cleave it, you've got more persons, all right? You keep doing it over and over, so you have a whole lattice structure of persons, which is interesting. It's a both-and sort of metaphor of, you know, the communio sanctorum, the communion of the saints. But the problem is if you look at ancient Eastern religions, you get the cosmology that the whole universe is a living creature. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they don't have any way to distinguish, again, hierarchically between, let's say, the three divine persons of the Christian Trinity and my personhood, and then the personhood of a cow or a horse.
Right.
But we've got to remember that Basil of Caesarea, one of the Cappadocian fathers, when he gives his, I think it's in his third epistle, when he gives examples of hypostasis, the word that's used for person, he says, well, Peter, Paul, John, and then unusually, you know, and when I came across this, I said, whoa, you know, there's another little indicator that there's something else possibly lurking in the background here. He also mentions this horse and that horse. You know? And I thought, okay, that's another curveball for Western thinking. You know, what's he saying here? And I think, again, what he's getting at is this distinction between the natural faculties of the soul mm-hmm. and the individual consciousness or I or ego, if you right. will. But it's an interesting, you know, this metaphor is a very unusual thing because I always warn people, this metaphor is, it's an acid drip on any standard philosophical system of metaphysics, because it's got a kind of what modern logicians would call a fuzzy logic. It's a both-and system. Mm-hmm. It's not an either-or system. And, you know, people have to be very careful, because it permits you to go in a lot of different directions. And, again, that's because of its mathematical nature. It's what you plug into
yeah.
those variables, you know.
I read a piece – a scholarly essay from in an old book in the Eranos yearbooks that dealt with Chinese alchemy. And what was interesting was that the Chinese alchemy had the exact same sort of Tetractus style graph, if you will. So it was, yes, where there's the one, and then you have the yin and the yang dyad that comes out of it, and then so, you know, all things proceed forth from the same. So in other words, if we look at Far East and we see the same principles in ancient Chinese alchemy, again, what it suggests is some sort of common origin.
Yep.
And I think that that's what, you know, what the perennialists and the perennial tradition is after, is looking for that origin.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you're highlighting. Do you see a connection there with the perennial tradition in this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely take this metaphor idea as being an indicator of the philosophia perennis, the perennial philosophy, if mm-hmm. you will. I definitely take it as an indicator of that, but I take it in two senses. I take it in the sense that it's a conceptual unifier. Because again, you know, it's a mathematical system. So the symbolizations function like X and Y in algebra. It's what you're putting into that X and Y that will change the way the metaphor is interpreted in this culture versus that culture. All right. But the other thing I think it's an indicator of is an historical conceptual unity. In other words, not only is this coming from a place of intellectual unity and mm-hmm. origin, it's coming from some historical civilization of a very high order, in my opinion, that had worked out in a very detailed way how all of this tied everything together. And we're just, in my opinion, quite honestly, we're just sort of on the beginning of trying to reconstruct this. I don't think we're anywhere near the sophistication that needs to be because of some of these problems I've just pointed out.
Yeah. Well, certainly the advanced tech that we know about is just fantastical. And so, yeah. I mean, there's no telling what else is going on. And I have argued in agreement with arguments you've made for so long that these advances have to be based on some alternate metaphysic, because the standard, as you call it so correctly, mass consumption physics, it doesn't make any sense. Sorry,
it's not working too
right.
well.
Right.
Well, in addition to that, I think that you know, I tell people all the time, I'm not a materialist. You know, if you have to put me within the Western Cartesian epiphenomenological culture of, you know, spirit versus matter, mm-hmm. I'm definitely not a materialist, because I just don't think that gets you very far. I think there has to be a transcendent, intelligible, you know, to use the Platonic term, an intelligible world. Mm-hmm. Otherwise we can all just kind of shut up and go back to our caves, to use yet another Platonic analogy.
Well, and we see so many mathematicians that are of prominent stature, people from Oxford, you know, leaning in that very direction, you know,
with
Max Tegmark or Roger Penrose or,
definitely.
Well, you know, they may not fully have theistic conceptions per se, but there does seem to be a unifying sense of, you know, that these mathematical forms exist outside of the, you know, the purely temporal realm that we experience. Let's get into banking, because you've done you have interesting theses on how this crazy physics and alchemy relates to banking. And I think you're right on that. Tell us about some of that.
Well, I've always had the presupposition that any financial system is also a cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
It's a physics. It's a morality, and that means that any time you look at banking, you have to look at the underlying assumptions. And a good place to start here is money. Money we tend to think of as a medium of exchange, but I ask people to look at money in a very different way. It's not just what does money represent, but rather who. And if you look within history, there have always been two basic approaches to money. The first approach is that money represents the actual human creativity and productivity of the surplus, so to speak, in ancient times, of the state warehouse, okay? And then you get the idea at a subsequent period that money is monetized debt. Mm-hmm. And I call that the facsimile of money because that's not money.
Right.
It's something very different. So what are we dealing with in cosmological terms? Well, very simply, if money is the surplus of human productivity in the state warehouse, if you know, to use the ancient conception, if that's what it is, then what the cosmology behind it is it's precisely that Platonic, Neo-Platonic, Hermetic, Christian, Jewish, Vedic cosmology of all of this is a fecund, creative, wonderfully productive process, okay? So there's no debt here, okay? There's no principle on things involved. It's an endlessly productive, creative process. Then, once you see money becoming attached to scarce commodities like bullion, which begins to happen at the precise point that you begin creating these big, huge empires of societies that are not simply your local city-state, but having to trade with somebody distant. Mm-hmm. Once that happens, once you have money becoming attached to a commodity that becomes, so to speak, in the modern terms, a non-renewable resource then money becomes debt. And now what does the cosmology become? Well, the cosmology becomes pessimistic. The cosmology becomes debt-laden. The cosmology begins to see sacrifice arising in this context of debt that has to be paid off. Yeah, you know, this is a huge thing here we're talking about. And, you know, let's look at India. What happens in India? Well, you have the rise initially. You've got this kind of creative, fecund, quasi-Neoplatonic cosmology. And at that time in Indian history, very prosperous cultures and so on. And then along come the Brahmins, okay? And the whole thing shifts into a debt cosmology. So they talk about the initial cleaving of this metaphor now becomes a body that becomes severed. You know, it's like the limbs are torn out of the body, and this is all sacrifice, you see.
So the priestly class comes in at the time of monetization.
Yeah.
Pay the gods.
You got to pay the gods. You right. know? And, you know, the ultimate expression of this, as you know, ends up being Anselm of Canterbury.
Yes.
In the 11th century in the Cur Deus Homo, where you get this idea that I'm summarizing the very beginning of the treatise, you know, where he says, in fine, leaving Christ altogether out of the picture as if nothing had been known about him, we shall prove with necessary reasons why it was altogether necessary for God to become man. And the necessary reasons turn out that man owes this infinite debt, this infinite principle, you know, which is drawing interest on the divine account books,
yeah.
which, being a finite creature, he cannot repay.
Right.
So God has to become man because God's infinite to repay this infinite principle.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. And in fact, when I was reading through David Rockefeller's memoirs, and he has a section. I mentioned this in an interview recently. He has a section where he says, my very first, my senior thesis in college, not his grad thesis, it's a different thesis, but my first thesis was on the notion of debt in medieval and late Western Christianity or something to that, Western civilization.
Yeah.
So I would really like to get a hold of that thesis because I think we would learn a lot from that, because I can't help but think that it has to relate to Anselm's notion of infinite debt.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, this is a cosmology, and it's a physics that's being talked about here, and it's a financial system that's being talked about here. And, you know, in that system, Christ becomes, you know, the balancing of the divine account books.
Yes.
And that has immense spiritual repercussions on the culture, on the sociology, on the psychology of the people living in it and trying to exist in it. And you go back and you look at these ancient cultures where at the beginning you don't have this idea, And you see this tremendous flowering of human productivity. And, you know, the other bad thing is that you look at these ancient cultures, you look at the Babylonian cultures where debt is beginning to enter in the form of, you know, people signing contracts and little clay tablets, which circulate, you know, these contracts circulate as money. So you have loans being made and then collateralized with their children or their farmland or what have you. And as debt piles up, production collapses in these societies because people just finally give up and they leave their fields. You know, they don't farm. So they instituted the idea of the Jubilee, you know, which you find in the Old Testament, but it's actually a previous Mesopotamian idea. You institute this idea of the Jubilee where the king comes out and performs the ceremony that's called the breaking of the tablets. And what he's doing when he breaks the tablets is he's canceling all debt. So that everybody can start. In other words, it's a reset.
It's just the reset. So where have we seen this recently in global economics, right?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. You know, now, there are papers out now, if you follow the financial world, I talk about this with Catherine Fitz all the time, and there's these papers, you know, where they're saying the debt is now so enormous that nobody can repay it.
Right.
So are we going to keep feeding that system? This is really the
debate. Especially that derivatives market is some outrageous, impossible, you know, fantastical number.
$17 quadrillion dollars, I think, was the last figure I heard on derivatives. Well, you know, folks, that's orders of magnitude more than the entire gross domestic product of the planet. I've got my spiritual suspicions as to who's behind that idea, but, you know.
Well, how does this play into, you have another work, which I've not gotten to yet. I've gotten through about four or five of your books. You have Thrice Great Hermetica, and this mentions finance, politics, and culture in the Middle Ages through the late Renaissance. So this sounds like what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So where do you take us in that book?
Well, that's a very complex book because what I'm trying to do is it's really a study of the implications of the metaphor is what it is. There's some music theory in it. There's a lot of finance in it. There's a lot of esoteric hidden tradition. There's a lot of covert operations in it. But basically what I'm trying to do there in terms of finance is flesh out some suspicions I've had about the relationship of the crusading orders, the Knights Hospitallers and the Knights Templars, to the Italian banking city-states, like Venice, Genoa, Florence. Because what most people, you know, you go through medieval history in a college and you'd think, oh, well, you know, nothing much happened back then because you're memorizing a bunch of names and dates.
Right.
And you're not reading it with, you know, with from the perspective that human nature doesn't change. So in other words, there's going to be conspiracies in the Middle Ages just like there are conspiracies in the modern age.
Right.
And there's going to be alliances and they're going to be covert and they're going to be doing things. So you have to read that history with financial and geopolitical eyes. Well, one of the things that most people don't realize is that the Knights Hospitallers were consistently very close allies with Genoa. And by parity of reasoning, the Knights Templars were consistent allies of Venice. Okay? Now, once you've said that, that throws the entire Middle Ages from that period into a very different set of spectacles by which to examine it, because Venice is, of course, the bullion market of Europe at the time. It's the international bullion exchange. And because of this, Venice was able, as I showed in Financial Vipers of Venice, Venice was able, through its manipulation of the gold and silver ratios in bullion supplies, literally to take out major competition in Europe. They did this with Florence in the 14th century. Because of this, they are able to host a great deal of covert operations. Now, the alliance with the Templars is crucial because there is, in my opinion, a good body of evidence to suggest that the Templars were going to the New World and keeping this a secret. And what they were doing is they were bringing back bullion.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes, you know, Venice, in other words, has a secret bullion supply that nobody knows about, which, again, has amazing parallels to modern times with the establishment of what I call the hidden system of finance
mm-hmm.
by President Truman after World War II, utilizing Japanese bullion and Axis bullion that's kept entirely off the books. So, in other words, Venice is kind of setting the financial oligarchical playbook.
Right.
Now, the other thing that we have to understand is everybody knows, you know, you read medieval history books and they tell you, well, Venice changed the direction of the Fourth Crusade and went over and sacked Constantinople, and Pope Innocent III had a fit, which he did, this was all just kind of happened. Well, no, it didn't happen, because when you read how this got set up, Venice was approached by, quote-unquote, six French knights, okay? Now, that's a code right there, folks. This is Templars going to Venice
mm-hmm.
saying, we need money for this crusade. And Venice says, sure. And when you read the amounts of money involved, you know it's the Templars, because France couldn't have afforded it at the time. So they negotiate this crusade, and then, of course, the story is that Enrico Dandolo, the Doge of Venice, redirects the crusade and sacks Constantinople. Now, I think this is all the cover story. I think the direction, given the Templar interest in acquiring secret information, which is very clear from the way they were founded in Palestine, I think the whole purpose of the crusade at the outset was to go to Constantinople, sack Constantinople, and find out what was in the imperial archives. And what was in the imperial archives here, in my opinion, is very interesting. I think it was a secret cartographic tradition that showed the New World clearly, okay? And there are indicators of this in the literature. The Piri Reis map, the Turkish admiral that mm-hmm. came up with the map of the New World and Antarctica. You know? And, of course, he's sitting right there in Constantinople, has access to all of the imperial archives. Well, it's very interesting in Venice's case, because after they sack Constantinople, two interesting things occur that indicate, number one, Templar involvement at the outset in this whole operation. And number two, indicate that the purpose may have been precisely to get and acquire some of that cartographic tradition.
Huh.
The first thing is, there's a letter from the Venetian Podesta to Pope Innocent III that is carried to Pope Innocent by a Templar. So in other words, Templars were in the crusade, okay? So in other words, that's the evidence right there that tends to get overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is that the Venetians do is the Podesta, the Venetian governor that they impose in Constantinople, is a fellow by the name of Marin Zeno. The last name is Z-E-N-O. Okay. And when I found that, I said, aha, bingo, there we are. Because this family, the Zeno family, is a Venetian oligarchical family. And it's that family which a century later has two members sailing to Scotland to hook up with Henry Sinclair, who then travel across the North Atlantic to the New World. Okay, mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of academics that discount that whole story. I'm not one of them. I think that happened because it's typical Venice. You know, think of Marco Polo, this mm-hmm. Venetian agent sent to China. And then, of course, he goes on that year-long voyage, supposedly to Japan, you know, and it doesn't take a year to sail from China to Japan, folks. So in other words, Venice is testing esoteric traditions here.
Mm-hmm.
And this to me is an indicator that, okay, by the end of the 14th century, Genoa and Venice, most likely Florence as well, know there's a new world over there, and their days are numbered unless they move shop. Okay, and this is exactly what I think happens. You see the Genoese Christopher Columbus making his deals with Ferdinand and Isabella, in my opinion, deliberately to find the new world. Forget all that cover story about trying to find another route to the Spice Islands. That's a cover story. And Piri Reis tells you it's a cover story, which is interesting. You know, why would a Turkish admiral know it's a cover story?
Well, let me ask you this. It makes me think of another researcher. I'll just leave it out, just to not be controversial. But his thesis is that that the Venetian black nobility banking scam made its way from Italy to another empire. And that empire, the British Empire, basically constructed, you know, the whole system over again. And that this was done by a certain Italian spy master named Paolo Sarpi.
Sarpi, yes. You're talking about Webster Tarpley.
I am, yes.
Yeah. Tarpley's absolutely correct.
Okay. I was going to ask you, but I didn't know if, yeah.
Oh, no. I like Tarpley's take on that because, you know, he studied this period of history, you know, at George Mason University and Catholic University in Princeton. And, you know, I taught medieval history and I'm noticing the same things, you know. And like any professor, I'm thinking, okay, there's a story here that nobody's really reporting.
Yeah, no, I never heard this. Yeah.
Yeah. And no, he's absolutely correct. Now, I'll tell you why. Let's do a little kind of thought experiment here. I don't know. You've probably had medieval history in college or been exposed to it at some point. Mm-hmm. And then you get the standard medieval academic presentation of the conflict between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines in Italy, okay, during the Quattrocento. And, of course, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, you've got the imperial versus the papal party. You know, that's the way they're presenting this to everybody, so that you all yawn and say, okay, yeah, this was some bygone age and they were all kind of a little superstitious and this really doesn't impact on us. No, contrary. The Guelphs is the Italian name of a family that across the Alps in Germany were called the Welfs, all right? That family, the Welf-Eibling family, of course, is related to who? The House of Orange. And what happens to the House of Orange? Well, you have the British Glorious Revolution. They bring over William III, stadtholder to Great Britain, to be the new king. And what does William III promptly do? In 1694, he charters the Bank of England. Mm. So what happens, you know, and that's just one example. You can look at other Venetian banking connections like the Fuggers in Germany, who are trained by Venetians that begin the Venetian system. What's really happening here, and I point this out in Financial Vipers of Venice, and I forget the exact year, it's in the 16th century, Venice clears all of its public debt, pays it all off. Mm-hmm. Now what they're doing, that's a clue right there as to what they're really up to. Because at the time they're doing this, Henry VIII, of course, is in contact with the Venetian canon lawyer and esotericist by the name of Francesco Zorzi, okay, to advise him on his divorce with Catherine of Aragon, so that he can marry Anne Boleyn. And you see this Venetian influence beginning to occur. And then, of course, later on, you have Giordano Bruno going to England and all over Europe. And to me, that's a key indicator right there that Giordano Bruno is probably a Venetian agent of some sort for, you know, working for the Council of Ten. All right. So he comes back to Venice and he lets slip, I want to start this secret society called the Giordanistas. And at that point, the Venetian fellow betrays him to the Roman Inquisition in Rome. And, of course, we know the rest of the story. So, in other words, they're trying to keep him shut up, you know. But
so, essentially, a lot of spy games is what's going on here.
Oh, yeah,
a lot
of spy games. But when Venice clears the public debt, this is a clue of what they're doing. They're converting everything to liquidity so that they can move shop. So in other words, all of the family fundi, all the family foundations, there's another key Venetian invention that we see in the modern age so very clearly, Ford Foundation, Carnegie Foundation, mm-hmm. Rockefeller.
Yes.
All the family foundations move out of Venice. So in other words, they keep control of their wealth, but the wealth moves.
Wow, that really is the foundation structure, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it really is the foundation structure.
This is Michael Corleone from Godfather 1 to 2 to 3, right?
Yeah, and you see what's happening now very clearly if you put it into a geopolitical context, because right. What's going on? With their knowledge that the New World exists, they know they have to move shop if they're going to keep their wealth and power and their prestige. So what happens? You have Genoa hooking up with Ferdinand and Isabella, sponsoring Columbus, and meanwhile the Venetians are moving through Germany up to Amsterdam and on into England. So in other words, they're pushing the center of their operation to the what will become the Atlantic powers so that they can maintain their family position and wealth. Now, if you don't think any of this is related to modern times, just think of Queen Victoria, who was fascinated with her family history. And what was part of her family history? Well, the Welfs. Mm-hmm. She was a Welf Este from that family, and the Este family in Italy is, of course, the De Este, mm-hmm. Este family. So in other words, yeah, this is a huge bloodline family finance spy game.
Wow, you know? Fascinating. Yeah, no, I had no idea that might be the impetus for the New World. But that makes perfect sense why it would be.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, as I point out in Thrice Great Hermetica, the Pope at the time, Giovanni Cibo, Innocent VIII, is again, we have the tie to the military crusading orders because he and the other principal papabile that was running against him in the conclave that eventually elected him are both described as knights. So, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah, right.
Ding, 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 right there, you know.
Now, so I wonder
really,
how
Columbus was, it's a voyage of revelation rather right. than a voyage of discovery.
Now, how far do you think this translates up into the modern world? Because I know in conspiracy banter, it's quite common to talk about, you know, banking and this and that, or people talk about the Vatican, or we talk about whatever. But what about Malta and Knights of Malta, because I think that does have an important it has an important place in all this, but a lot of times it's passed over, except for certain groups who want to say, well, it's all the Vatican that's running everything. Well, I don't think that it's all the Vatican, but I think that the Knights of Malta is important because there are so many CIA MI6 ties to Malta.
Yes. Let me give an analogy so that people can get out of their head this idea that there's one locus of all powerful, omnicompetent planners orchestrating everything. In other words, it's not the Zionists, it's not the Vatican, it's not the bankers, it's not the Rothschilds. What you have in the international deep state, so to speak, is a mafia.
Yeah.
And around the mafia table, you know, the dons, think of the Godfather when all the dons are exactly. getting their rings and they're sitting at the table and they're making their deals. And then they all put their in smoking cigars and sipping brandy and getting along as the best of friends, like at a Bilderberg meeting. And then they all go home and they shoot each other. Okay. That's what's going on.
Right.
There are several factions and they're all in this mad scramble to be the dominant faction during the end game when they set up their big global government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mr. Putin has other news for him, but but that's what's going on.
It's right. rival factions, right.
It's rival factions. And there are rules of the game.
Right.
There are. Now, where does the Sovereign Military Order of Malta come in? Well, that is essentially the continuation of the Knights Hospitallers.
Right.
All right. And it does have international sovereignty. It is recognized in law, international law. So you can literally travel under a diplomatic passport as a member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. Now, here's the interesting thing to those people who don't think this has any tie-in to any modern event. At the time when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, the governor of Oklahoma was a fellow by the name of Frank Keating.
Yep.
All right. And I'd actually corresponded with Governor Keating a couple of times when I was working in the Oklahoma college system at the time. So, you know, a nice guy. He wasn't mean or anything. But interestingly enough, Governor Keating's brother wrote a novel prior to the Oklahoma City bombing where a federal building was bombed. And the guy that performed the deed was a fellow by the name of Tim. Okay.
Right.
And in addition to this, Governor Keating is the guy, one of the people, when they picked up Andrea Strassmeyer in Roland, Oklahoma.
Right.
Traveling on the interstate without any plates. They put out a BOLO alert to pick this guy up. Governor Keating, after he had been picked up by a state trooper and held in the jail, Governor Keating called that particular sheriff and said, "You've got to release him. He's got diplomatic immunity."
Right.
Now, interestingly enough, Governor Keating's a member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta.
Wow. So, and by the way, that book that you're mentioning, when you open the cover, it says in the cover, there's a dedication to the Knights of the Circle or something.
Yeah.
Something to that effect. I don't remember the exact phrase. And it's not talking about the Knights of the Golden Circle, but it's saying, you know, dedicated to all my fellow knights, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, this is very powerful. I'll tell you who else was a member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, and that was Bill Casey, Reagan's CIA director.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was. So, in other words, this is huge. You know, they use these networks very carefully and very deliberately.
And Casey called his agents under him, he called them Templars.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there's no accident here, and it also makes me think of Breivik and all his Templar regalia and all that, too. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, deep state games at work here. We're getting an hour and 40, so I guess we'll go ahead and come to a close, but what can we expect from you in the near future? What are you working on now?
I just finished a book that'll be coming out with Adventures Unlimited. David Childress told me that probably the end of July, early August. It's called The Third Way, and the subtitle to that book is The European Union, the Nazi International, and Corporate Fascism. It's kind of bringing the Nazi International part of the story up to the modern period. And I know it sounds just totally wild and bizarre to think there's any connection with the European Union and all of that, but
exactly. And the plan of, people like Alvin Toffler writes about the third wave, after Industrial Revolution, Technological Revolution. Now we have to go to this third way. That's the sort of merger of Western capitalism and communism, right?
Yeah, and it's nothing but fascism.
Right,
that's all it is.
Totally.
The book has three. The whole book is very controversial, but there are three chapters in particular that are highly controversial. And I don't go into any detail. I just contacted David Childress this week about another book that I'm researching and have begun to write, which hopefully will be out in February. I don't have a working title right now. It's going to be on, let's just say, on well-known events and finance and a different sort of read of the events than it has had thus far in most people that deal with that event.
In terms of global finance, you're saying?
In terms of global finance, in terms of scenarios of how to interpret what happened.
Okay.
And who was involved. There are some glaring problems, in my opinion, as to what may have happened. You know me, I'm a synthesizer. I look at everybody else's research and I say, well, wait a minute, you know, here's this and here's that. So yeah, it's going to be kind of continuing that whole story of international fascism in yet another way.
Okay. Well, excellent. We'll look forward to that, and I'll have links to your books and to GizaDeathStar.com. Is there any other sites that anybody needs to know about, or is that just the main one?
Those are my sites. You know, all of my blogs are on my site, and then they automatically get posted to Facebook and Twitter and okay. so on. So,
and you have a YouTube channel too, I think, where you load up your reports. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Farrell. I'm very honored, and I appreciate it. And maybe we'll talk soon in the future.
All right. Thank you for having me back on, Jay.
All right.